Hello, everyone, and welcome back to RPG R&D. I am one of your hosts, Jess Geyer. I'm one half of Wannabe Games, and I make tabletop role-playing games. And I am here with my co-host, Craig Campbell. Hello, Craig.
Hello, Jess. I am Craig Campbell of Nerd Burger Games. I own that company. Yes, I am a small business owner. And for the record, as a note, if you own ferrets, if you own just a few ferrets, you are also a small business owner because a group of ferrets is called a business. If you own a lot of ferrets, yeah, then you are a large business owner. We're here again with Ben. Ben's back. Hello, Ben. Thank you for joining us.
Hello. Thank you again for having me. Yes. So I am Ben. I am a very tiny indie producer of games such as Lightning War, a fantasy World War II RPG, and Murder Ballet, a rules light John Wick RPG. And as of this last month, I can add educator and substitute teacher to my resume. Woo! So,
oh, yeah. Yeah, what's your favorite class you substituted for recently?
My first day was the eclipse. And it was,
It's all downhill.
No one was there. So it was basically like getting paid to read my library books.
Everybody skipped it. Nice. I thought maybe you'd be talking eclipse stuff.
Oh no. Everybody skipped it. So that was the easiest day I have ever worked of any job ever.
Okay. But, were you in the path of totality?
No. We got like 80%. So that was the easiest work day I've ever had. any job. Nice. The rest of the week I was babysitting middle school in school suspension, and then middle school social studies, and next week I'm doing high school business and language arts. So
that's fun.
Yeah,
I have only done long-term sub positions before, you know, like I got my teaching jobs, so I don't know what it's like to like skip around and do all those different classes. That sounds like a ton of fun. And we need good substitute teachers. So thank you.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it too. And yeah, it's like every school I've talked to, it's like, oh, great, we need subs.
Yeah, absolutely. No, and like seriously, I took the day off to go to totality to see the solar eclipse. So it's thanks to substitute teachers that is able to happen. Although I would have gladly quit my job to have seen it because it's like seeing another world. It's like seeing another plane of existence, if you will.
Oh.
Oh, wow. That reminds me of a good podcast topic.
Go ahead. Set us up.
We're talking about planes as in different levels of reality, different worlds that are maybe layered on top of our own planar style, maybe multiverse, maybe mirror universe. I don't know. We have to kind of define this. What does it mean to be planar, to have a plane? What the heck? Ben, you chose this topic. You get to define it.
All right. So a helpful way to think about it for me, the Dungeon Crawl Classics rulebook has a bit about traveling through portals, where it says, you know, to your average fantasy adventurer, getting teleported to the sixth circle of hell and being teleported to an alien planet are the same experience. You know, subjectively, they have no way of knowing whether they're on another planet or in another dimension. So the easiest way to describe another plane is just another world. It can be another dimension, it can be another planet. How you get there can totally vary depending on your settings. The fifth edition DM guide talks about like how, yeah, in Greek mythology, the Greek underworld was just a place you could physically walk to. And then there's, you know, fairy circles and all that kind of stuff where like, no, you've got to be in the right circle of mushrooms at the right time of day during the right solar conditions in order to get portaled somewhere. So
doing the right sort of mushrooms, you know.
Exactly, yeah. So.
And they can be huge. They can be little, they can be one room. They can be like, you know, absolutely anything.
Yeah. Yeah, just it can be another world, it can be a big world, it can be a small world, it can be the TARDIS, it can be whatever. It's just somewhere else. really.
And they also like do like pocket dimension kind of stuff. I'm thinking like in Jujutsu Kaisen, what do they call it? Like their special ability, and I completely have blanked on the name. They do a special ability, and a lot of times it's transporting their enemies into this world of their own creation where the rules, the physics, everything is different. And it's their own kind of design or creation there. I think for me, the way that I define a plane as versus a different world is that it is a world that you can't access by mundane physical means. So for me personally, I would have not classified the Greek underworld as its own plane, but rather another place on the mortal dimension. Same thing with Mount Olympus, literally there on the planet. But compare that to, for example, in Norse mythology, you have Valhalla, which is not a place that you can access physically. You have to be dead to get there, or a god to get there. And that's like personally how I define it. However, they're not real things, so it doesn't really matter how we define it. It just matters how you personally want to define it as a GM or as a game designer. But for our purposes of our topic, our conversation, I'm totally happy with it being another world just in general where things are different. Things are weird and different from how they are in the character's average day-to-day life.
Yeah, the one other kind, like I guess the reason I kind of love, oh yeah, you can go there. Like the reason I would use the Greek underworld as an example. You know, if you think of like basically just portals or even just like Alice in Wonderland, you know, down the rabbit hole kind of thing. A lot of stories that involve what D&D and similar games would consider interplanar travel, the characters do not realize that they are plane hopping from their perspective. They're like a bunch of kids just went into a wardrobe and came out in a snowy forest. They don't realize that they just hop dimensions. They're just like, when did the coats turn into trees?
So, Oh, yeah, that's fascinating too. Just, keep going, sorry.
So, however the planes may be arranged in like a metaphysical way in your setting, how you get between them can also be, there's also a lot of room for creativity there.
That's one of the things that I have swung widely on my opinion of regarding like, okay, here's a description of like, if you have to find a particular place and you have to have, you know, so that you need a door basically, and you have to have like a means, a special thing, and usually a key, right? So a key to open a door, whether that key is a physically a key or whether the door is physically a door. That's, you know, a kind of a traditional sense to all of it. As far as like, no, I can seek out this plane. I can go to this other place. I think as, you know, as GMs, one of the things that can make extraplanar travel as interesting as possible is not just having one means that just varies. Like, oh, it's just a different door with a different, you know, physical key that's made out of a weird metal or something, right? But having like different planes have very thematic means of entrance and egress, and they aren't necessarily the same. Like the entry and the egress might be different, and there might be things that happen to you when you enter and things that happen to you when you leave, as opposed to just walking through a door because you happen to have, like, you know, a dark metal key that you put into a dark metal door, whatever that is, for, you know.
Yeah, I mean, the classic example, and I mean the classic example, is The Wizard of Oz, where getting back from another plane can be its own adventure in and of itself. So,
yeah, I think as a GM, you have to think about how special the planes are in your game that you're playing. Of course, the book, whatever book you're running or game you're running, is going to have some guidance. Well, maybe it won't. Maybe you're just kind of going off the cuff here and adding your own thing. But if you want it to be a special experience, you should start by making it a special experience. It should be an adventure to get there. It should be an adventure while you're there. And it should be an adventure to get out again. And that can make like just the, we're going to try this kind of arc. We're going to be, yeah, we're heading to the lunar plane where everything is moon-based. Okay. And I've done this and send them to the moon, basically. But like, how special are you going to make it there? Or is it mundane? Is this something that they just do all the time? In which case, how are you going to keep like kind of the magic fun of planar hopping alive? Maybe it's like a monster of the week kind of idea. You have a different plane every session. You're going to a different place. You're learning new things. Or a combination thereof. Maybe plane hopping is the adventure. You're trying to get back to your original one. What's that show?
Sliders.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think if the game revolves around plane hopping, it can get perhaps tedious to have every finding your way to the plane be an adventure, and then you have the adventure on the plane, and then finding your way back being an adventure, because that starts to kind of spread it all out. And maybe you want the focus to be more like, okay, every episode, every game session, we're going to be in a different place, or every story, we're going to be in a different place. It depends how long you're going to spend there and how many you feel like you're going to jump around to. But one of the things you can do with that sort of a game is set an expectation of, you know, for want of a better metaphor or example to use right now, is like, you know, the key in the door. Like, okay, well, you know, you got to use the key in the door at this time of day. I need to get to this place, and the key in the door, this place. And then the players come across like one that, it's not going to be a key in the door. It's going to be a whole production. And you can make that particular voyage to that particular plane be a much bigger deal and be kind of different and interesting. And so you're, you know, pulling the rug out from underneath the players and saying, okay, this one's going to be a little different, so that you do shake it up every so often, so it doesn't become rote and oversimplistic and just like, you might as well just, you know, get on your horses or get in your car and drive to wherever you're going. Like, if you're just going to open up a door with a key every time. But you can, you know, mess with that. You can mix it up a little bit. Yeah. If you're going to only occasionally go to another plane, I think it's much easier to make like the whole production out of that one time you're going. Especially if there aren't a lot of planes. If you're playing a world, like let's say you're playing a game that was essentially Stranger Things. Well, getting into the Upside Down needs to be kind of a production. Each time you do it, it's kind of, it's got to be special, because it's going to be a messed up place when you get there. There's going to be really bad things happening, and you're going to, you know, Barb's going to die. And
hey, spoilers,
whatever. The show's been around for like 20 years. I'm sorry. You can go back and cut that out if you want. even if you didn't watch the show, everybody saw Justice for Barb on the internet for a year. But the point being that, yeah, you can make kind of a thing out of it. And it's a balancing act, really, right? You know, with anything that is going to get repetitious as a GM, like having a fight, you know, just combats can get repetitious if you don't shake things up every so often, if you don't do something a little different. That's one of the things that one of the problems that I had with, that I still have really with D&D games, and that I have with plane hopping in D&D, is that it's like the combat started to feel like, we're just having another combat. It's a little different. There's like, you know, this bad guy has different spells. This monster has a few different abilities, but they all start to feel kind of the same unless you're really finding ways to differentiate them. And the planes can be like, we were remarking, I'm going to go ahead and start this ball rolling, because Ben remarked before we started recording, which was like, you're going to go to the Great Wheel of in D&D, and you're like going to go to Hell and the Abyss, and then the other 13 planes that nobody cares about, which is to say, you know, an argument can be made that there are too many planes that just don't have a great flavor in the Great Wheel, because there's just, you know, like one for every alignment and one for every in between the alignments, and then one for every element and one for every in between the elements, and then one for every element. in between that and the positive plane, and one between that and the negative plane. So you got dust and, you know, like lava and all this other stuff. And it's like, oh, that's just, there's just so much stuff. It's like, well, what makes all of these things special other than the fact that there's just so many of them, and that you can have unique creatures there, and some of them are homes to gods.
Yeah. And even then, like from the unique creatures angle, it's like, off the top of my head, the only, like, the upper planes have like angels and archons. There's the one in between heaven and hell plane that the Yugoloths are from. And then it's like, you got Modrons and the weird frog things from Limbo. And it's like, okay, but like, what about Hades? Like, Hades is a location you can go to in D&D, and I don't think there's ever been a single adventure set there. And why would you? Because there are 9 levels of hell and infinite layers of the abyss that you can go to instead. Like, when the abyss has an infinite number of subplanes in it, do you really need places like Carcerai and Hades and Tartarus?
Other than if you had, like, if you wanted to go deep dive into the cosmology and the religion and everything that there is in there, and be like, oh, we're the GM, you know, is like, pick this particular god or servants of them, or this particular, you know, dark demon-y monster, whatever it is, not necessarily demon, because that's not what, you know, just whatever, like, we're going to take you to this plane. It's like, okay, well, what makes, like you said, what makes Carcerai different from Hades? What makes... They're dark planes with evil creatures in them. So let's spice that up. So, you know, if you're GMing, you can find ways to do more of that.
Yeah. And kind of on that note, I think there's an element of like the law of conservation of ninjutsu when it comes to like planar adventures and stuff, where like, you know, one ninja is a super serious threat. 100 ninjas are no problem. You're going to blast through them like it's nothing. In a campaign where you're going to different planes every session, I would prep that the same way I'd prep a sci-fi campaign where you're going to different planets. Each plane would not need to be so different from the previous, from like a, you know, there can be the cool environmental stuff the same way there's like, oh yeah, this is the cool Star Wars planet where it's like the whole thing is a volcano. Like, you don't have to get as crazy with how you get between the planes and stuff like that in that adventure. If it's like the spirit world in Avatar The Last Airbender, where it's the only other plane of existence in the setting, that's when you got to make it a big deal about how do you get there? How is it different? What are the rules like? And kind of similarly, when it comes to mechanically designing planes and everything, I think the worst thing you can do is just make it more of the same.
Yeah, it has to be special in some way. It just has to be. I mean, it's also the problem I have with D&D's realms, like, or planes or whatever. Why does it have to be good, evil? That is boring. That's boring. Good versus evil, you all you did was do heaven and hell. That's been done before. I want the goofy realms where, like, in this realm, gravity works backwards. I want there to be physics changes. I want there to be changes to the way that your spells work. I want a total rehaul of what the mechanics can or cannot do in your game to represent what the physics can and cannot do in these other planes, in these other realms.
You want everyone to have hot dog fingers in one of them?
That's what I said. Yes. That's what I said when my internet cut out, actually. I literally said I want the realm where everyone has hot dog fingers.
Yeah. And like, to that point, like, do people have, like, do we all have favorite mechanics from another plane of existence? Not necessarily in a video game. Or in a tabletop game, like, you know, it can be from a movie, a book, or anything. Like, what's like another plane from media that you saw and you were like, yes, I want to do that in a tabletop game?
Oh boy, that's putting me on the spot. Jeez, I'm sure there's plenty. I might have to.
I've got two examples.
I'll pipe back in. Okay.
Yeah, let's hear your examples.
Ready to go. So the first one is a throwback to Metroid Prime 2, which was one of my favorite games when I was younger. I won't say how much younger for the sake of everyone else here. I am kind of the baby of the group. But so Dark Aether in Metroid Prime 2 was the kind of stereotypical dark dimension, mirror world, upside down kind of thing. But the main sort of challenge of it was because you were not from that plane, the atmosphere itself was toxic and corrosive to you. And the Luminoth, those moth aliens who were fighting a war in the plane before you got there, left these beacons that basically create little bubbles of safety inside Dark Aether. And so for the first part of the game, until you get the upgrades that let you not die in the atmosphere, a massive part of the gameplay while you are in Dark Aether is moving from safe zone to safe zone. And that puts a completely different spin on combat because the enemies can disable the safe zones, and your mobility in combat is limited to where the safe zones are. So if you get caught outside of one, you know, and the enemies can kind of bully you away from, you know, getting it, you're on a clock because you're going to corrode to death and just die from damage over time if you don't get to that safe zone. But also making a run for the safe zone leaves you open to the enemies. So it completely changed the way you approached combat and encounters while you were in that dimension. And, you know, another kind of easier to implement example, I think, is the slow zone from The Expanse. You know, basically it's this portal hub kind of thing, and there is some kind of AI force that imposes a speed limit on everything that goes through there. And so the characters find, you know, after a grenade goes off, that the speed limit has changed, and suddenly, like, just any kind of projectile weapon stops working in the slow zone. It's just, it's flat out not allowed by the rules of the plane anymore. And, you know, if you implement something like that in a tabletop RPG where you do have firearms, like a sci-fi RPG, that is immediately a huge shift on how the players have to approach combat. So yeah, those are my two examples.
I thought of one. There's a Stephen King story called The Langoliers, which posits the idea that there is no traveling to the future in the past. There is no, there, time is not a continuous stream, that we move through time, but it is temporary. So when in the story, characters are on a plane, the plane magically transports to this other realm, which is basically the near past. Which is to say they get to a place where looks like the world, but everybody is gone except them, because all the other people have moved on with the world in its present time. And this place isn't going to exist forever. There are things coming that are going to eat it all up and destroy it. And when they get there, before they meet the creatures that are basically going to eat the world, they recognize there's all this other stuff that's happening that's like flavor. There's no smell, like nothing has any taste. Like there's all these sound doesn't travel the same way. Like everything's deadened. So it plays the idea that, like, you know, this is a dead world that's soon to be gone. And you know, the story hinges around them discovering all of this and having to get home and so forth. And there's, you know, a variety of characters who come in conflict with one another. but it was always a really interesting idea that, like, there is no future or past. It's like you're in this one bubble, and there is this one place you can go, but there's ostensibly a place just into the future where something is building everything for you to inhabit when you get to it. But just in the past, there's this place that's being deconstructed. There's a Twilight Zone or like one of those shows that does something like that too, where characters go to both the future and the past, where they see the present being built and then they see the present being deconstructed. And somebody describes the world as functioning like a train car. You bounce from train car to train car. The world moves from train car to, when you moved into this train car, now this train car needs to go away.
Yeah, for me, like, I adore The Legend of Zelda series. And when I was a kid, Twilight Princess came out, and I think Twilight Princess did a really good job of this idea of this other plane. Like, here is the Twilight Realm that is a map over the top of Hyrule, and when you go into the Twilight Realm, you like Link himself transforms completely. He becomes a wolf. He can't use all of his same powers, but he gains these new ones, and that's like the kind of thing I like to try to capture. Like, this is, I mean, it's almost kind of like the Upside Down, except I feel like the Upside Down is very unfleshed out now. To be fair, I've not seen the most recent season. Maybe they expand on it in Stranger Things, but the Twilight Realm feels so very fleshed out. It feels like when you go in there, the things you do there are different than what you can do in Hyrule, and the things you do in Hyrule affect the Twilight Realm and vice versa in different ways. All of those things are very interesting to me as a player of a video game. And then they do the same thing in the most recent Legend of Zelda as well. In Tears of the Kingdom, there is a whole world underneath Hyrule that is a reflection of the world above. And I think I really like an idea of this other realm being something that is connected to the one that you're from, and that the consequences of doing certain actions in one realm, they have consequences reflected on the other realms and vice versa. I think that opens up to a lot of really interesting puzzle play that you can do in your games. It opens up a lot of opportunities for you to have like some fun, jokey kind of things, like, oh yeah, here's the shopkeeper who's like a total jerk asshole in this tavern, but in the other realm it's like a complete opposite, or he's the same in every single realm, and that could be something for the like, yeah, oh my god, it's Mustache Man, Mustache
J. Jonah Man. Jameson, every yeah. every Spider-Man's J. Jonah Jameson is just yeah a jerk.
Yeah, I mean, I think that all those things could be I just really like that about, I mean, Zelda's been at it for a while, even in the games before I started playing. They did a lot of that as well. And that's my ideal. But I'm a huge Link hit, so.
Yeah, no, the Zelda games were also a big inspiration. Actually, the Zelda game, A Link to the Past, inspired the developers of Metroid Prime 2 to do the whole Dark World thing for that game. So
yeah, it's cool as hell.
Yeah, it is. And they used, you know, they consulted with like the team, and they did a lot of the same kind of puzzles where it's like every now and then you'd find an item that was the game called it like in a state of dimensional flux. And that meant you could interact with it in both universes. So it would be like there was a switch or something that was only accessible in the Dark World, but then activating it would move something in the Dark World and then also move the corresponding thing in the Light World. So you know, you had this kind of mirror dimension thing where you know, you'd go into the Dark World, totally redecorate a room to solve a puzzle, and then you'd go back into the Light World and it would be fixed for you.
Yeah, it does present a challenge when you're playing a role-playing game with a group of people. If you're GMing something like that, for example, it's not as fun to be like, okay, you do this in this world, and now you have to go back to the other one and figure out the other side of the puzzle and then go back. That's not as fun as when you do it like with a controller by yourself in a video game where the mechanics are taken care of within the programming of the game. However, you can kind of reflect on, like, take some of those elements, like, what does it look like when you affect something in the mirror realm? What does it look like in the regular realm, whatever you would want to call it? Maybe it appears as natural disasters. Maybe they are spectral ghosts that people see in the world. And maybe when your characters are starting off, they know about these magical natural disasters. They know about the giant ghosts that appear in the sky. They know about the weird songs that, like, whatever it is. And it's not until they can discover how to go between those worlds that they actually realize, like, oh, that's just people messing with it on this side. And you don't necessarily have to be doing those sorts of puzzles, but you could still have the same sort of thematic and like cool emotional impact of, we're doing something big here, we're doing something big and magical and messing with the dimensions. which is really all I want as a player.
And I will say, from a GM prep perspective, mirror dimension, multiverse, dark world kind of stuff is a lot easier to prep because you can recycle every single one of your maps.
Like, yes.
Oh, dungeons the players have already done? Well, okay, you have to go back and do the dark world version, and there's totally different higher level monsters there this time, and the puzzles are different, and some of the rooms have been moved around. But for the most part, you're recycling all of your old maps. So mirror worlds are great from a amount of GM prep to amount of player material perspective.
Yeah, definitely. Like, you can just go into Photoshop, even if you do use maps, and be like, okay, this one's a little bit more purple. They got some cool clouds. They got to change a little bit here. And if you do it too, if you do, like, here's the same dungeon, then what did all of the switches and the traps they set off in the original realm, what does that look like now in yours? And they can see, like, maybe the traces of what they did last time they were there, quote unquote, last time they were there. And that could be really fun. Maybe they killed the big bad monster, and there are some, like, consequences to the big bad monster in the dungeon in the mirror realm, but the big bad monster in the mirror realm is actually an NPC they needed to talk to, someone they actually need the help of. There's lots of fun things you could do that. I love the idea of, like, recycling the maps. You're right that it will make your prep easier, but you also takes a little bit of forethought and planning to make it, like, really, really cool.
Yeah. Like, if you know going in that you're going to be doing a campaign that has a Legend of Zelda style dark world, you can plan accordingly from the beginning for the players to have to do all of the dungeons twice and for them to be totally different the second time. Yeah. Or if you just need to throw together a session really quick because you didn't have time to prep that week.
Yeah.
You're in the Shadowfell and it's last week's dungeon, but upside down and backwards.
See, I love the Shadowfell in D&D. That's the plane that I actually like.
Every time I've done anything in the Shadowfell, I've treated it like the Twilight Realm or the Dark World or in Zelda game, where it is the evil negative version.
I don't like it to be evil negative version. I just like it to be, like, dark and depressing, and we have no emotions here.
Well, what about designy things? This can apply as GM, just kind of house ruling things in, and it can apply to designers of you know, your own game if you're looking to have other realms. What sorts of things can we do from a game design perspective, both narrative to make and narrative and mechanically to make alternate realms and planes of existence interesting?
So I want to circle all the way back to the D&D planes for a second. So the reason that all of these adventures use the Nine Hells and the Abyss instead and none of the other planes is because those planes are interesting because those planes have conflict. There are all of these scheming demon lords, and there are all of these scheming archdevils, and there is all of this infighting between them, and alliances, and backstabbing, and drama, and conflict. All of the things that make your regular RPG setting interesting, all of those same rules and principles still apply when you're designing planes. Like, I had a note here where, like, you never do any adventures in the good planes because the good planes are where, you know, it's heaven. Everything is all, like, you know, perfect, and there's no conflict and nothing to do there. Well, yeah, that's boring. There's no reason to go there. But what if you had factions within the angels where, like, you know, they're more honest and they're more democratic than devils, but they're very split on where the line between helping and controlling is? Well, now you have two different flavors of good guys, but what they consider good may not necessarily be good for the world that the characters are from. And now you have drama and conflict and a reason for an adventure in heaven.
Or the conflict is you're there now and you're not perfect and you don't belong. And you know what angels do to things that aren't perfect and have evil in their hearts. And that could be its own conflict. And you could, if you wanted to play in heaven a little bit, maybe it's before the creation of hell. Maybe it's right at that time where, you know, some angels like thinking,
maybe I should be in charge.
Yeah. I don't really like the direction things are going. I think we need new leadership here. Maybe you arrive right at the time of the war between, I don't know. I guess it's the war of the angels because it's not hell yet. I think, or in the time of apocalypse, maybe you're arriving right there. You know, there are some fun things you could do. I just think that there are more interesting things you could do, and I don't think that D&D handles it very well, which is also really disappointing. I did say I was going to talk about this a little bit. I read through Daggerheart, the playtest for Daggerheart, and it's all they did was take the same realms and gave them different names. No. That's really all they did.
Oh no.
Yeah, it's a little sad. They had opportunities if they want to play in like this planar cool space. They had opportunities to do other things. But their core realms, they have the mortal realm, which is the material plane. They have the hallows above. It's just heaven. They have the circles below and then the realms beyond. And that's it's just D&D again. Like, you could have made it. You could have done more with that. It didn't have to be like that. And yet, here we are. Yeah. Sad, but true.
Can I tell you about alternate planes that I've designed and tell you about maybe one in particular and make you feel better?
Yeah.
That you can do really interesting things with planes? There's a supplement for Good Strong Hands called What is Light Without Dark? And it's very heavily built around the idea of these other realms. There's the core realm of Reverie, which is the fantasy world that Good Strong Hands is set in. And over the eons, the void has sundered pieces of that realm away and made these other realms. Like a couple of them existed beforehand. Like there's a version of the Underdark that's called Tanglemuck. It's basically like the Underdark or the Upside Down. But there's other ones as well. And the one that, Reverie is built very much about around fanciful kind of fantasy. There's a realm called Remembrance, which is the place where, memories, childhood memories and old toys and, imaginary friends go when the child forgets or outgrows them. And so it's a very morose place and it's filled with all of this sadness of like, oh, all these things are lost. All these things are gone. They were once sources of such great joy and they are no more. And in order to enter the realm, you have to find a place where you can kind of get across, and there's places like climbing into a toy box. But you also have to tell the realm, because the realm is kind of alive, you have to declare a cherished memory or an object. And if it's an object, you have to bring it with you. And then when you leave the realm, you have to make a heart check. And if you fail that check, you lose that memory or that object forever. And can never get it back. And while you are there, even one of the twists, I don't get super explicit, but it's definitely implied in there, is that there are phantoms. There are these spiritual things that are the what's left over of, like, for example, imaginary friends. This is where Bing Bong from the Pixar movie Inside Out gets kind of dark. They're there missing their child with all their soul and all their heart. And some of them are kind of angry about it. And they want nothing more than to get back to their child. And they will do anything they can to do that. So they come looking for you, outsiders, who come into this realm because they can sense you're there. You don't belong. You're not a lost memory. And so that's what I built the whole thing around. And it's just, you know, I was in a very contemplative mood at one point when I was kind of coming up with ideas for realms. And I was like, you know, there's these things that we lose. And what if they continued to live in some way, and it was all very sad. And so I built an entire realm around it, and it's fitting to the kind of the theme of the game, I think. And it's, you know, there's conflict there because you can run into these phantom things. There's things that are lost that you can kind of search for. There's beings that may or may not help you. And the void is all, you know, during the game, the void is always a potential adversary, because the game is always built around when you're fighting the void. So there you go.
Yeah. So that would be a fun thing to do. Like, only people from your character's home realm can go between these planes, but there are denizens of these other planes that want to travel, and maybe they try to latch on to the characters to try to travel with. I think that there could be a very interesting path to go down too, just either as a GM adventuring, like, yeah, these angels want to get the heck out of heaven and they want to come to our world, so they need to hitchhike with you. You could even do like a whole like, oh, we're like helping people cross the border illegally, basically. Like, we are the people trying to get these people out of here. We're helping refugees, we're doing whatever. Like, that could be a really fun way to mess with planes. Just something, what you said about the memories trying to get back to their kids reminded me of, like, gave me that little idea.
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, and there's my favorite location in the realm is Dolly Mountain, which is literally just a giant hill of dolls, and it's just constantly raining more lost dolls onto it.
I can't really think, like, all of the other planes that I've designed have been pretty standard, I think. As far as the, like, you know, for my little fantasy heartbreaker thing, I had a slightly more complicated, more conflict-driven heaven plane, a pretty bog-standard hell plane, the pretty bog-standard fairy plane, and then this icy void plane, kind of based on Tartarus from, like, that old cartoon Sinbad thing, where kind of similar theme. It was basically where all of the forgotten stuff lands. It's like entire lost civilizations wedged in between, like, shifting glaciers, and it's just like you've got meteors of, you know, buildings and cities and stuff falling and then landing in this awful glacial snowscape and then just being buried and forgotten all over again. That was probably like the most out there I got with it. But yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, there's got to be some kind of conflict in the plane. And the other half of it too is, I think there's also got to be some kind of mechanical thing for the planes to make it feel different to them as well.
I was gonna bring that up too. I think if you, it could even be something as simple, like, you go to the plane of fire and any fire magic you use is twice as big and twice as powerful, which can be great or not for you. Or, and then, like, your ice, like, people who have ice, they, that it doesn't work at all. Or you go to that, you go to say in D&D, you go to a lawful good plane and now none of your warlock evil eldritch powers work anymore. Here they don't do what they're supposed to do. You're not in connection with your lawful evil, with your lawful evil gods anymore, whatever you are doing. I think that there are, like, actual mechanic things that you should, if you are designing a planar world, that's probably going to be the heart of your mechanics. Make sure you, if you want it to feel different, the mechanics should be there to support that feeling of difference. Don't make the GM do everything.
Yeah, like, I remember the fifth edition DM guide had, you know, in its overview of all of the standard D&D planes, it had, like, sidebars for each one where it was like, here are a few ideas on how to make them mechanically different.
Yeah.
And, like, I remember, like, the Shadowfell and the Abyss, it was both like, oh yeah, you know, you gotta roll or else it changes your personality traits. But like, it's like, wait, that's the same mechanic for two different planes. And it doesn't affect how the characters go about adventuring. It's purely a role-playing touchstone thing. And yeah, like to the point with like the I think I just lost my train of thought, but it was somewhere in the neighborhood of like, generally you never want to like just totally shut down all of a player's abilities, but tweaking the way the spells work for better and for worse is always a pretty safe, reliable way to make stuff feel different. But then there's also like, well, how do you engage like the characters who might not have any of that stuff? What if it's like just a low magic setting already? And the fact that they're on another plane, in and of itself is like a big piece of weirdness. In those kinds of situations, you know, it's always one of the ones I see a lot is gravity. Like, oh yeah, this plane doesn't have gravity. Very cool premise from like a world building perspective, very hard to execute from a GM perspective, especially if you're a group that plays on a grid. This was an issue that came up in an adventure set in Limbo in D&D organized play, because it was like, oh yeah, hang on, we can just push off the wall and zero gravity our way across this room. We don't have to deal with any of this stuff.
There are certain attributes that you can give to a realm that are at first glance look like, oh, that's a neat little weird thing about this realm. But they're also just like, as soon as you have the tool, it's no longer a thing. Right. And so I warn people to be careful about implementing that. It's going to D&D again. It's the disease problem, the problem with diseases. Diseases are great. Oh my God, my character has a disease. Okay, well, we just got a high enough level caster that can cast cure disease, and now diseases are never a problem anymore. No gravity. Okay, well, now we all have like some, you know, ability that we can telekinesis ourselves around, or we have magnetic boots or whatever it is, right? And then now that's solved. Ideally there's more to it than that. If that resource that allows you to to bypass the problem is a limited resource, or, you know, only lasts for so long, or, you know, that sort of thing, that becomes a different beast. Like, you can find yourself like, we need to get from this node to this node in the time that we have available to deal with this problem. And once we get to the new node, we can recharge that ability or whatever, right? You can, you know, but it puts you on a clock of like, now we need to get from one place to another in a certain amount of time. Otherwise we're kind of hosed, or we're going to be dealing with other, you know, significant problems. That's more interesting than just like, well, I got the magic phlebotinum, so now the evil thing doesn't, you know, the problem situation doesn't affect me anymore.
And I actually jumped to the complete opposite end of the spectrum on this one. Net running in games and cyberspace and all that kind of stuff. At the total opposite extreme, especially in a game like a cyberpunk game where cyberspace is basically another plane, but it's one that the at least one player in the party is going to be in most of the time. Especially in a lot of like the original cyberpunk games and some of the older stuff, there was always this kind of problem of everyone would be at the adventure site doing their own thing, and then the netrunner would be back in their apartment doing their netrunning thing miles away from the rest of the party and never really in any physical danger, but they're omnipresently spidering into everything from their computer. And at the total opposite end of the spectrum, those games had completely separate rules for doing everything in cyberspace, which kind of just made it a giant hassle for the GM, because you have all of the other players playing by one set of rules, and then this other player playing a completely different game. And so how do you toe that line? And I guess it would be easier when all of the players are in the same space, but how do you keep the mechanics familiar enough for the players that it doesn't feel like you've totally pulled the rug out from under them in other planes.
Yeah, that's a tough one. Yeah.
If you want to have mechanics, yeah, you know, mechanical differences, it's tough. If it's a narrative thing, like, oh, well, you're like, I handled that in Capers Cyberpunk with like entering cyberspace is just it's a flavor thing. It's narrative. There's not really a whole bunch of other weirdness going on there. Yeah, that's a difficult, because it does necessitate splitting the group up, or well, and you know, like you said, having like two sets of rules that you're playing under.
I mean, it could be part of the experience too. I remember playing that game specifically and thinking like, yeah, I mean, sure, it might be hard for my GM right now, but I'm having a blast personally. So I think it really does depend also on the type of game that you're making and the players that you're hoping to cater to. And I think especially better with a game that has a much tighter premise, a much smaller in scope game involving planes or net running or whatever it is. If you are making a game specifically to explore that, and there are different mechanics completely in each set, and that's, I think that that's easier to handle when you're not also trying to balance a game of this is D&D and this is the, for better or for worse, the everything game. You can't have those really complex mechanics and then also have really other complex mechanics doing whatever else. I think it has to be pretty simple. I do think that you could do something like you could have a set of mechanics that are ostensibly the same. You have a number and you add a skill to it or whatever, and then you have some planes, you do this with dice, you have some planes where you do this with cards, you have some planes where you do this with a set of numbers you've already pre-generated, and then the base mechanic is the same, but the medium is different, and that could work out without so much lift from a GM. Is the balance going to be completely there? Probably not, but who cares? It's planes. They're not supposed to be balanced, are they? So you could figure, maybe play around with that. I'm just speaking off the top of my head for this. Of course, I've never even tried something like that before.
But yeah. And it could be like kind of extrapolating from what Jess said previously, which is there's an audience for every game, and maybe that's just the experience of this game. You're going to make a game that's going to have two completely different rule sets, and people who play that game are going to deal with that, or they're not going to use the hacking stuff and they're just going to play the other parts of the game, or they're going to house rule the hacking stuff into something that they want to deal with. And you know it's not like players ever like just hack what you designed anyway and turn it into the version of the game that they want.
No one ever does that.
No one ever does that. I've certainly never done it. But yeah, I mean, you can just say, okay, well, that's the way it's going to be. Like when I stick myself into the digital realm, I suddenly have these, like my stats do weird things because my physical body means nothing anymore. So all my mental and social stats are all now important, and I do different things, and I have to make different kinds of roles to do different things. And
yeah.
Oh, that brings up another very, very tiny nitpicky, but very important point as well. Specifically picking on the cyberpunk examples again. The Star Wars RPG, the D20 based Star Wars RPGs had this problem too, but for different reasons. If you are going to have another plane kind of superimposed over the regular plane where players are going to be semi-regularly going back and forth, there should not just be the one everything skill for the stuff you do in that plane. It like the classic example is like the hacking skill, because we're talking about netrunners and junk. Mm-hmm. If the only thing you ever have to roll while you're in the cyber dimension thing is your cyber dimension skill, then that's the only skill that your character needs to get good at. That is the only thing that your character needs to build around. And that's not super interesting as a player from a character design perspective either. So whatever rules you do come up with for the other planes, make sure there are multiple ways to engage with them beyond just like a single type of skill or a single stat.
Idea for a zine. I'm going to do it because I have a bunch of stupid zine ideas that are just for fun and jokes. Planes, you have the first through the fifth plane. And in every plane, you're using the different mechanics from the various editions of D&D.
Oh, no.
You go to the second plane, you have fifth plane, you're using your fifth edition mechanics. You go to the fourth plane, you're using fourth edition. You do have to have a character created for each one.
Well, we've gone to the first plane. What are you now? I'm an elf. An elf what? Not just an elf. I'm just an elf.
Yeah.
All elves are elves.
When I was, I mentioned at the very beginning of this, I think it might have been before we started recording, that my first D&D edition was fourth edition. And in my wide-eyed, naive ignorance, I thought that D&D editions were like college textbooks and the rules didn't really change that much between editions. So imagine the shock and horror on my 3.5 group's face when I naively threw a fourth edition monster at them.
That's funny.
I was like, yeah, it says here that it's a fortitude is a 15. And they were like, what?
Sorry. Yeah, I mean, that's fun. I'm going to make this scene now. yes, this giant rat that you fight in this realm might not be that bad, but you send him back a couple of realms. You try to Thaco this rat, and it's not gonna work out for you.
Yeah, but I don't even have an epic destiny.
sucks to suck, I guess. Ben, do you have any final thoughts for us about planes?
I was just kind of thinking about that too. So kind of going all the way back, like the through line between everything we've been saying here has basically been make it weird. It can't just be like just another location, because otherwise there's not enough to really distinguish it from anywhere else in your setting. Just make it weird. There has got to be something mechanically weird or narratively weird about it. It has got to be weird and different, or else it's just another location. That really kind of sums it up, I think.
I think that that's exactly correct. And how weird you get it, that's a design problem. Ben, thanks so much for coming on the show. Where can we find you?
I am becoming harder and harder to find as social media implodes on itself. I am on Blue Sky. I'm not super active on there. I think I'm still at Ben Sandfelder on Blue Sky. I have not been able to work on games in like the last year, which is killing me, but I do still have an itch.io page, Games Inc., where you can find Lightning War and Murder Ballet. But yes, as the useful internet withers and dies, I am becoming harder and harder to find.
I understand.
Yeah.
Same. You can find me at Wannabe Games and at Wannabe Games on itch and DriveThruRPG. That's where I am.
And you can find me at Nerdburger Craig on various social medias. And go check out Hypersleep Terminated, because that's on Kickstarter.
Ooh. I'm good.
It's a space disaster game.
Thank you to our opening and closing theme song, which is Avel by Steph Sachs. Thank you, Steph Sachs. That's not a tongue twister, but it twisted my tongue. And thank all of you for listening. And we'll see you back here next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.